So first off, I release you from your commitment to silence in this retreat. And thank you for keeping it so well, because it was a nice, it was a beautiful environment in which to practice. So thank you one and all for watching your own minds. And yes. So for the next, now that you're able to speak, for the next 40 or so minutes, I would like to just offer some observations of my own, of advice about daily practice and how you can actually, you know, take what we have been doing, and especially if you're returning with great inspiration, how you can really turn this into an enhanced practice at home. And then, so I'll just raise a number of points of my own observation. And then when something resonates, you know, so you, a point that you have some observation of your own, I'd love to hear it, you know, and because all of us can probably benefit from not just my experience, but from your own experience of trying to make a daily practice and a meaningful path out of these teachings that you hear. And so just raise your hand, and then if there are multiples, you know, just call on one after another. And then at some point, we'll just have to say, and that's all we have time for. But the first observation that I have is that, what does it mean to cultivate wisdom and compassion? Well, it's like a gardener, isn't it? Cultivating. So you don't just throw, a gardener doesn't just throw seeds on the ground and then expect a bed of marigolds. You know, you have to cultivate. You have to plant the seeds, they germinate, you tend them, and then you get to enjoy the beautiful flowers. So it's like that, you know, cultivation is a really precise term, I think, for our practice. You know, what we have a goal in mind, and we have to tend it. So not only do we plant the seeds, but we have to tend them. And the way that we tend them is with practice. And practice isn't perfect, of course, you know, but we're becoming consistent in our practice. And so the most important thing in practice is to make it daily. And so if your meditation practice is inconsistent, meaning that you practice for a couple of days after you hear a teaching or you're inspired, and then it becomes infrequent, maybe you figure, I'm too busy during the day, during the weekdays, but I'm going to make it up on Sunday, you know, by practicing 2 hours on Sunday rather than daily. So that doesn't work. You have to make your practice, you're cultivating. So are you going to water your flowers only, you know, once every 2 weeks? Are you going to brush your teeth only every 2 weeks? You know, this is, we're talking about mental hygiene. And so make it a daily practice. And if you are really, really busy, so it's said by several masters that if you really are focused on shamatha practice and developing the single-pointedness of shamatha, recognizing its importance on the path, that you can do that actually in about 3 hours a day of shamatha practice, of dedicated shamatha practice. But there's a big asterisk there, and that is depending on what you're doing with the other 16 hours or so that you're awake. And so if you are just filling your mind with media, for instance, and entertainment, and distracting your mind constantly at every opportunity when there's a silence during the day, the 3 hours isn't going to produce much, and it may, you know, might not even be treading water. So you really have to make a lot of lifestyle decisions if you're going to make progress. But if you don't have the time for doing 3 hours a day, that doesn't mean that there's no possibility of practice. So I think the busiest person in the world could find a half hour during the day to practice. And so if you're one of the busiest people in the world, here is what you could do. And that is, and the basic strategy, remember, for developing shamatha, but this is really, I think, true for developing habits of perception as well, is that short, frequent sessions is really important. And so the short doesn't mean that it's not beneficial and can really reset your day. So in a half, you have only a half hour during the day. So the busiest person, and if you don't have a half hour in the day, then we need to talk. because it's not even a half hour all in one gulp. So you can start the day with 12 minutes. Before, you know, you can have some tea or coffee if you're, you know, daring. But before you get busy, definitely before you check email or anything like that, just spend 12 minutes of doing practice. And so you have a range of practices you can do now. And then the strategy is what Alan calls seasoning the day. And so season the day then with practice. So do 6 minutes of practice. Sometime if you're a working person, your day may be really scheduled. So give 6 minutes to a session sometime before the end of your lunch break. So, you know, if it means that you eat a little faster, you know, and you just sit down, or you've got 6 minutes before your next appointment, you know, rather than check social media or sports scores or whatever, or the news, sit down and do a 6 minute breath meditation, or just rest in pristine awareness for 6 minutes. And then do 6 minutes before dinner, sometime during the whole afternoon. So you get the idea. You're really seasoning the day with these short, frequent sessions. And then that leaves, so that's 24 minutes right there. And then do 6 minutes before you fall asleep. So that could be after you actually get into bed. But you just rest in, you know, you can do breath meditation. You can do any of the techniques that you've learned. But that is going to be a lot more beneficial, seasoning the day, than just doing a half hour of scattered meditation in the morning. And then what will happen, very likely, is that you will notice that that 6 minute meditation really resets your day. And it has the power to do that. You know, just 6 minutes of breath meditation, if you're feeling anxious or really, or even if you're feeling anxious, full of excitation, or even if you're feeling lax, that 6 minutes of meditation can just really reset the day, and then you're really ready to perform. So I do this all throughout the day because I have a lot. One of my leisures and fortune is that often, most of the time, I have time, you know, I can master my own schedule. I have a lot of commitments, but I can decide when during the day I'm going to do them, more or less. And so a lot of what I'm doing deals with a screen, working on a computer. And what I notice is that after about an hour and a half, my mind just gets fatigued. And I notice that things become less fun, everything becomes effortful, the quality goes down, the production goes down. So what do? I sneak away and sneak in a gatka or two. Generally not more than two if I'm busy. But then I go back to work, and what I notice is that after somewhere around 6 to 8 minutes through the first gatka, especially if my mind is lax from fatigue, from mental fatigue, that all of a sudden it's back and bright. And if you go into a session with your mind somewhat fatigued, your stability can be really good, you know, because you don't have the energy of excitation. So those can be really, really excellent sessions. And I notice the same right after lunch also, right after lunch and right after dinner. What I want to do now, it used to be said, one of my lamas said, never, 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 never try to meditate within 2 hours of a meal. You know, like going into the water, you'll get cramps. But so that has become one of my favorite times to meditate because I kind of get sluggish and I don't have the energy of excitation. So you know, things just are a lot more stable, and you can surf the edge. So anybody have anything to add about that? Robert.
First of all, thanks for the teachings, as usual, are inspirational, and they really advance my practice every time I hear you. Thank you. The thing about surfing, that little comment that you just made, I used to try, when I first started to meditate, first 90 days after getting your first workshop, I wanted excitation, because that's the way I work. I'm type A, I work hard, I drink a lot of coffee, and that was exactly the wrong strategy. It was what you said has really worked for me, and it really opened up my practice, which was to surf the hypnagogic boundary, using the breath. Because if you catch the laxity, it's exactly what you said, I'm just following your instructions explicitly. If you catch the laxity when it's incipient, it's a very small adjustment, and excitation doesn't blow you off the object. And then that also allows me to step into the awareness practice with much more stability. Because excitation if I'm first stepping into the awareness practice with too much excitation, grasping is a problem, I have a trouble with maintaining lucidity. So, you know, surfing the hypnagogic boundary has been, so I look forward to practice when I feel drowsy, and then when I get stand up, the light's brighter. Exactly. That. That was such a gift, and I didn't understand that until I had your instructions. Thank you.
Great, thanks, Andy. Yeah, Brent.
I have the opposite issue, because I am dull. So I use Insight Timer, and I set it for a 6-minute nap, and then half Gattaca or Gattaca. And so you could have it programmed in, go right to it. Luckily, my work allows for it, but that's something you could do too on the other end of the continuum.
Great, yeah. So you take a 6-minute nap before the Gattaca?
Yep.
How interesting. And you wake up after the 6 minutes ready to meditate.
I could fall asleep right now. So it's a talent that I have. I'm not sure. And actually, on the Alan Wallace Facebook page, people talk about that too.
Huh.
So, but that's a strategy. You share that? Okay.
How interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. I had never would never have even thought of that.
You're not dull.
Well, thanks for that.
I'll take it right to you. I was gonna support that essentially as well. I started meditating before I knew what meditation was, when I was way over my head in academics and was lying in Shavasana, essentially going to the infirmary, doing yoga nidra without knowing what it was, and 12 to 14 minutes every time I come back. And now if I'm exhausted, I know I'll come back. Now it's about 8 to 12 minutes, and then I'll meditate after I fall asleep, which isn't normal sleeping.
Okay, this isn't my real question, but I'd like to ask Robert, what is the hypnagogic boundary?
It's a point right by the lighthouse. No, it's so when you're falling asleep, right? You're actually doing almost an awareness practice, because you usually like just release your attention and you open up and then you start to drift down. The dullness gets greater, and what I find I can find the hypnagogic boundary before sleep, which is it's when my mental appearances change usually from discursive voice to visual and quite abstract. That is the hypnagogic boundary as I define it. And if I go deeper, the snoring starts.
Okay, so here's my real question. I try practice daily. Don't always make it daily, but I'm still trying. And I'm wondering in my practice, what would be the appropriate role of guided meditation? How much, how frequent, you know, I'm concerned that I might get too hooked on guided meditation and not go into freely into my mind and look at what's there.
Uh-huh. Does anybody have a comment on that? Going to wait for me?
I have the same question.
Oh, you have an offer, comment? Yeah, there you go.
I always felt like, yeah, that the goal was never to use guided meditation and just be on your own, that that was just a bit of a Band-Aid approach. But I found that it's really, really nice to use some guided, both really. But what invariably happens is when I go to guided meditation, sometimes I do because I'm so agitated and I want to meditate, but I can't. So I turn on a guided meditation, and that's really helpful. And then I can calm down and do an effective meditation. But it never seems to fail that when I turn on a guided meditation or a teaching, it's exactly the issue that I was having is responded to. And it's just amazing. It's intuition, probably. I mean, I just randomly can pick, you know, a teaching or a meditation, and it's the perfect one. So I would encourage everybody to do a lot on your own, because we do want to be like that, especially when we're off the cushion. We don't want to always have earbuds in, and we want to be able to do meditation as we're walking around or walking the beach, an awareness kind of meditation. But also not to feel like you can't, you know, that you have to give up guided meditation, because I think it's so valuable too, especially from our wonderful lamas that we have. They're just amazing, amazing guided meditation. So that's my thought.
I don't know if you call it kiss it, but it's like, keep it simple, stupid. I just do a lot of deep breath meditations. I really do a lot of my meditation when I get up in the morning, because that's when I have most of my energy, and I'm not in a rush because I get up pretty early, like 5 or 6. Uh-huh. But I just do, 12 to 15 minutes and do deep breath. But I'd like to get back into doing guided meditations. I just need a place to put it. I'm not really good with my computer. But thank you. It's just simple. But I have the same feelings as the other people.
Mark had something?
I think the thing for me is on good days, which because I'm retired now are more frequent than they used to be, I can get up in the morning and get to the cushion almost right away, and I've been doing it on a pretty regular basis. But it's at bad times, either during, that may come up during the day, where it's almost, there's almost a willful, I'm feeling miserable and damn it, I'm not going to feel better and I'm not going to go to the cushion. It's just very difficult for me to get there when it's really stressful or really difficult. Something's happened that's made it, as I've lost all clarity and all balance, and it's just very, very difficult for me to get there at that point.
Yeah, at that point, what you could do is just go to the infirmary then and not have any goal for your meditation, but just lie there and relax and just focus on the exhalation. And that should be pretty easy and inviting, because there's nothing to achieve, no effort involved, and it becomes a real sanctuary then, especially if you're focusing only on tactile sensations. You have gone to a place where mental afflictions can't follow.
Would that be better than going to the Tobin Bridge and jumping off?
I don't have any experience with that one, but I would imagine so.
I had a client once who is the only person I know of, and anybody in Boston knows of, who literally jumped off the Tobin Bridge, changed his mind, which we don't know, obviously, if that's a common occurrence or not, but he landed in the water, and there was a boat close enough, and they came over and picked him up, and he did live.
Yeah, I'd still recommend meditation.
If you're really amped, sometimes if laying down a challenge, a nice walking meditation in nature will just gently ease you back down into it. And maybe you could go lay down. nice walk outside.
That's also a good time to go to sleep.
I found that.
Because, working? Can everyone hear me? Yes, I guess so. Because I do work when I am completely out of it as far as communication is concerned. I've got a big set of headphones on, and I have numerous guided meditations, which I really like, and sometimes stack them up and say, okay, I want to listen to this one today, and this one here when I'm over here, and this one here when I'm over there. And yeah, I love guided meditation, but I don't let it get in the way of my at least two regular meditations a day, which I do in the morning and at night generally, but that's just me. And but like I say, I've got the kind of job where I don't have to hear anything else and would rather not.
Yeah. How wonderful that you're listening to guided meditations rather than Metallica.
One thing I just wanted to address is the meditation off the cushion while we're doing the dishes or the laundry or tuning into the breath. I think that's a really sweet way to kind of bleed the practice into the rest of our hours and days. I find in the work that I do, therapy sessions with people, that total focus on someone else for 50, 60 minutes is a kind of meditation. I also wanted to say something about the jumping off the bridge. There's a film that I screened in September about a man who suffers from mental illness, bipolar disorder, who survived jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. It's a really incredible film called The Ripple Effect. Stephen Hines, he was 19 and jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge. And he said as soon as he left the railing, he regretted it. And it was quite miraculous. I don't know that there's anybody else that survived that. A dolphin came and stayed with him until the boat found him. And he said that his thought on the way down was, if I survive this, I want to help other people. And it was quite miraculous the way he landed, that, you know, he can walk and talk, he didn't injure his spinal cord. And he has devoted his life to helping people who have suicidal depression. So I just wanted to add that. But I think also when people are severely afflicted by mental afflictions, mental illness, meditation can be a really powerful tool, a really powerful medicine. And I'm finding with my patients, we start with a 3-minute in the session, showing them much from what I've learned from you and in cultivating emotional balance. It can really change things up. And when people see that in 3 minutes they can change their mind, they can have another view that they don't have to be caught in those ruminations, it's really powerful.
Yeah.
Thank great. You.
Yeah. So in Tibetan practice, it's often said there are two meditation sessions during the day. There's the session on the cushion and the session off the cushion. So the opening remarks here have just been about on the cushion more, or you know, and then if we have time, we can talk about all of this off the cushion stuff also.
I wanted to follow up on what Lama Rick said about walking in nature. And I find that I do this frequently, and I use this opportunity, especially now in the spring when we're starting to hear birds, sounds that come in, and my mind immediately wants to categorize, that's a cardinal, and you know, and all of a sudden I'm off thinking about what it must look like and where its mate is. And so what I do is I haven't used taking a walk as an opportunity to see sound as just sound and colors instead of, oh, the lilies are about to bloom. It's very challenging, I must say, because I just delight in all of that. But I find that to be a very powerful exercise. And I guess I wanted to also say, in my work, I teach meditation to people who often have never been introduced to meditation before, and the thought of a daily practice is not, there are a few people who do have a daily practice, but most of the people meditate with me once a week for half an hour, and that's it. So I would love to hear more, and it sounds like, right as I was about to get the microphone, I was going to ask, and it sounds like you're going to answer this question, but if I could offer some suggestions off the cushion, I mean, I do the best I can with the information I have in my own experience, such as walking and tuning out that tendency to want to define every sound and every sight and just see it more as I said earlier, as a way to withdraw the senses a bit and not set that discursive mind going nuts. But if you have other suggestions about ways I could suggest a regular meditation, like daily meditation, off the cushion, it would be helpful for me to share.
One that I have suggested in the past that in Gloucester gets rave reviews is beach meditation. So just it's the same thing that you were just talking about, Jenna. Start at one end of Good Harbor Beach when the tide is out, and especially during the winter when there are no people there. And you just walk across the featureless sand with your head cast down so you have a visually homogeneous field. You're not distracted by sight. And you're just then tuned to tactile sensations and sound. So the waves crashing is, you know, really compelling. The cold wind, the sand under your feet. And you just try to make it from one end of the beach to the next, mindfully, without being totally distracted. And what people who have never meditated before or aren't meditators report that they're, you know, what I tell them is that basically you're doing the same thing as breath meditation by selectively narrowing the focus, the scope of your attention, to a chosen field. And then just trying to sustain it there. So either what you're doing described or beach meditation, but basically the same thing. But the point is to choose an object to direct your, so for most people starting would be attention, choose an object to choose your to direct your attention to, and then just keep going back to it. Notice when you've been distracted and just keep going back to it.
So for example, with that instruction, someone could be, a lot of my students come in on the public transportation, so they could do this while they're commuting and pick a point on the floor, or is that what you mean? It could work in that way?
Yeah.
So as an object?
You choose, or yeah, you can narrow the scope to a particular sense field. And right. The one like you and I both have discovered, sound is a very good one. Because it's easier to have conceptually unelaborated experience of sound. I think it's the easiest sense field to do that. Sight is very difficult because we're just so tuned to seeing things that are, you know, already identified as a thing. But sound, it's easier. You can really watch the process of the conceptual elaboration, identifying what a sound is and describing it.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And then just in the last few minutes, the other important factor then, because you're only on the cushion, so if you're just starting this practice, so either 3 hours, shamatha practice, or a half hour a day broken up in the way that I described. Obviously, most of the time is off the cushion. So Tibetans say there's the session on the cushion and then the session between sessions on the cushion. And so you've got, let's just say, 16 hours a day when you're not on the cushion. Does that mean that you're not practicing? So the attitude that you should begin to develop is that your practice is full time, you know, 24 hours a day. And why not? Why would you choose to be mentally afflicted and deluded? This is my time off. You know, I practice for a half hour and the rest of the time is mine to be deluded and mentally afflicted. You know, because delusion and mental affliction are both painful. And what you, the more time that you spend doing this, what you recognize is that there is, let's just say, pleasure, but it's of the bliss family, of in wisdom. And so when you see appearances for what they are, you're looking out at just, you know, a natural scene, and you see it for what it is, which is a mental appearance, there's pleasure in that. And then whenever you feel the constriction of reification, there is the, that, I hate to say it, tell you this, but that is the dissatisfaction of dukkha, of samsara. You can feel the dissatisfaction of samsara in every moment when you're reifying. So your whole practice then, as you are between sessions, why not just be doing vipassana practice all the time? Because it feels good. You get insights into wisdom, into the, what, you know, see appearances for what they are, and it's really reinforcing because it is pleasurable. And then that's the basic overarching statement. And then the point is that I think that in our when we return home, the challenge is to take control of our lifestyles and not feel like these are accidental, you know, or these, my lifestyle just kind of happened as a process of accretion of habits over the, you know, time. And, you know, this is the way I live now, just because, I don't know why, but it just kind of happened. But to make conscious decisions about the way that we spend our time and prioritize and figure if this is really important, doing this 24-hour practice, does that really require that I reevaluate the way that I spend my time, the amount of media that I consume, all of that, the people that I see, the friends that I cultivate, all of those things, if they, so in when we do the practice that Lama Allen calls the fourfold vision quest, to what is my heart's desire, so we started off with that. But the whole goal of that is to find this heart's desire, and if it's your answer to what is my heart's desire, my big life's goal, then the way that I think of that is that that has the gravitational mass to pull all of your other life's decisions into orbit around it. And so that's what you want. That feels like a state of grace, frankly, when you have that. That is meaning and purpose, you know, and then all of a sudden it's like, you know, everything is enchanted. And all of your life's decisions then become very easy because you just know, I have to ask, does this support my big, hairy, audacious goal, or does it somehow interfere with it? And there you have it. You know, it's very easy to make decisions that way. But 3 minutes of comments on tailoring a lifestyle and making conscious lifestyle decisions to support practice. Anybody have any observations about that? Anita. Rick had the microphone, and he yields his time.
I would say that the biggest one for me is quietude. Having time alone, not being too busy, which is challenging because when you identify your goals, you may think they're important, they're beneficial, but I think the word that I use is balance. And we're living in a busy world, so quietude, we have to kind of factor that in, I think, or we're not going to get it.
I 20 years ago, I moved into the place I'm living now, and I had a stereo in every room and two large screen TVs, and one of them was always on it all the time. Now, and since probably 6 years, 7 years since I started the techniques that you taught, just the starting of meditation on a daily basis immediately ramped down my need to have those on, and now I've given two-thirds of them away, and I almost never have any sort of media on. I'd never watch any form of radio or television media-based news or information because it isn't news and information. It's incredibly upsetting. If I want information, I find written, analytic, data-driven things. Otherwise, it's just so reactive. And then lastly, I'm very careful about who I spend time with. But I make a conscious attempt to find people to spend time with, especially if I have energy to help them. And then the last point is, goes on with the meditation off the cushion. When I'm interacting with someone, and I'm not very good at this, this is practice at this point. It started with you when you talked about beach meditation, being out in the world and like focusing on auditory. I was practicing that and found out that was successful. I came back from Garrison retreat 2 years ago, hit a traffic jam outside of Danbury that was the worst one I've ever been in. It took almost 2.5 hours to cover 20 miles, okay? And what I did is, sitting in the car, I practiced mindfulness of breathing with peripheral attention successfully in the car, because the peripheral attention was aided by the fact I had to watch when the car ahead of me moved, which didn't happen for 5 or 6 minutes at a time. And I was able to stay on the breath. And I was so delighted by that experience, and that was not my normal reaction to that kind of traffic jam, right? And then lastly, the interaction with people. When I've selected to be with someone, to be really peripherally attention, stable attention and peripheral awareness in balance, it is incredible. You see emotions moving across the space like electricity. We are socially connected creatures and do not require, we have a lot of channels that we get information from people on if we're awake and present. That's my
answer. Great. Gail had something in the back, and we'll just close it with that comment then from Gail.
Yeah, so an extension of what Robert was saying, to bring everything onto the path. So if you're in the worst hell realm, which probably, I know I am sometimes, to be able to observe that and breathe into it, breathe out of it, and, you know, bring it onto the path. And do that when you remember to do it, as many times as you remember to do it throughout the day, off the cushion.
Wonderful. Well, I wish we had more time for that. But at some, it's probably time just to draw the curtain. One of the comments, so I actually have a long list of things here, of observations about practice. And one of them is to practice in a community of like-minded people. Because that really does support your practice, and you get the feeling of what, you know, this natural affection that we have for people, like-minded people practicing together. It's very, such a common, a similar experience that we all had, you know, of the last several days. So that's really, really beneficial. And I know that, so it's very, you know, with that, having said that, I think it's very appropriate that this particular retreat was sponsored by What Do You Think, Inc. And so, but I, by that I don't mean that corporations are a person. So I'm not thanking What Do You Think, Inc. I'm thanking Rick and Lindsay for sponsoring this retreat, because they were instrumental in bringing Dharma to Cape Ann. in the beginning. So how wonderful that they are still producing events, you know, and bringing this community together. So very appreciative of that. Thank you so much for making all this possible in the many ways that you did. And so as community then, the one opportunity that I know that you have to come together to practice every week is with the classes that Rick is teaching at the Anisquam Village Hall, which is a marvel. Are you really? Oh, wow. So, you know, it is really a marvelous place to practice, and Rick's a fabulous teacher, and so, you know, everything he's teaching this coherent path as well, you know, all everything, he's just really breaking it down into, you know, all of the steps along the way. So, you know, don't avail yourself of that, and don't think that there's, you know, so take advantage of the community that we have here. And then thank you, Mary Kay, as well, for a year of insisting and putting this together. And, you know, it wouldn't happen. So if somebody didn't tell me to teach, I wouldn't. You know, and then I would be stuck in my own little mandala, and I wouldn't have learned any of the things that you just learned, because I wouldn't have, they wouldn't have occurred to me, you know, to really immerse myself in the texts and the teachings of Alan and all of that. So thank you all for giving me this opportunity to immerse myself so that I have something that I hope will be of benefit, and I hope it has been. And so thank you, and I wish you all the best in your practice. Oh, and just one last thing about that. Please teach, I don't know when again. Yeah, because coming up for me, I have these two retreats that I mentioned, so ending in beginning of September, and then from there I probably will go directly to Italy from France, and then I don't know if I'll ever leave. but I probably will, because they might not let me stay. So, you know, part of it depends on their visa issues and all of that that's still working on. But our project, as I said, is going to likely get the permits to begin construction in September. And then because I'm the project manager or director, that this is really where I have some experience actually in working with construction projects. So whether I live there full time or can live there full time is still unknown, and all of that. So I don't know what the future looks like beyond September at this point. And I've already canceled a retreat that I had scheduled at Wonderwell for November, and really am not at this point scheduling anything new beyond September, because I don't know what my commitment is going to be there. But there is a possibility, but you just kind of we have to be nimble and be able to respond to opportunities, maybe on short notice. What's that? Yeah, so I have to make that decision coming after I meet with my crew in Italy. But yeah, I don't know whether that's going to happen, whether I'll be able to go back there or not. So Mary Kay has some thank yous, I'm sure.
So,
I would not stand right in front of this.
Is that what that is? So this is the sixth residential retreat we've done with Lama Doug, as I calculate it. For me to do this is just the easiest thing I do. And it's partly because I have a well-oiled team, which is mostly everybody in the room. Because as you notice, I don't hesitate to ask for help. But particularly, I want to thank Karen and the rest of the setup crew, which included Craig and Rick. And Robert did all kinds of things around the edges. And we even drew Keith in. He's only been with us a little bit now. He's part of the helping crew. And Jenna and Victoria, fabulous snacks. Best ever. They were really, really helpful. And of course, Nursey Anita over there is always here to help us. And it's no thanks are needed. It's just if you're going to thank anybody, thank yourself, really, because everybody's been wonderful. And I can say that through most of the retreats we've done in various places, I kind of like this one the best, I must say, because it's spacious and they're so accommodating, and the food gets better every time we come here. So we'll be thanking the Wonderwell staff during lunch, which is really nice. So, I'm sorry, because the next thing I was going to say was about Wonderwell, so just thinking ahead. Yes, Rolling Ridge, thank you. So a year ago, when we were at Wonderwell, another fabulous retreat by Lama Doug, we instituted a closing ritual, I believe, thanks to Anita. She said, well, we should do the dedication that His Holiness likes, and from Shantideva. And I think you all have that.
I don't have a copy of that.
And, sorry.
Thank you.
So, to ensure that our Lama stays and teaches us again, how appropriate that we can make a beautiful dedication to that opportunity to come our way, and also to have our Lama stay, and that's on the back. So at Wonderwell last year, along with this ritual that Anita established for us, the idea came that we do want Lama Doug to stay as long as space remains and until all sentient beings are enlightened. So a group of us, many of us in this room, wrote a request to Lama Allen that we have a long life prayer for Lama Doug. And you'll see on the colophon, is that correct, on the bottom, how that all came about. And so now, as part of our closing ritual, we do this beautiful dedication, and then we follow it by praying for our Lama's long life. So with that, let's do the dedication prayer from His Holiness. And may all beings everywhere
plagued by sufferings of body and mind obtain an ocean of happiness and joy. By virtues of my merits, may no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled, with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drink. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvest. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound by be freed. May the powerless find power, and people everywhere think of benefiting each other.
And now the long life prayer for Douglas Veenhoff, entitled Asking a Rainbow to Remain. Shimmering rays.
Then flash your the wrong person for this. And what can be said really about you and what we can offer you. So there are no more words, but I threw a mo. And I literally picked up the first creative effulgent sea spume or spontaneously actualizing pamphlet that jumped out in front of me. And I marked out some words, but I didn't add any. I'm a weepy person, so, and I'm super grateful, so this will sound a little babbly. I'll try to pull it together. It's entitled Walking the Labyrinth. The labyrinth is a path. There are no tricks to it, no dead ends. There's no single way or right way to walk a labyrinth. The only choice you need to make is to enter the path. As you walk, consider what is your natural pace and find your own rhythm. You don't need to think about anything. You may simply want to be open to the energy and spirit of the place. In walking the labyrinth, it's possible to discern shedding, letting go, releasing cares and concerns which distract us or block the spirit. Quiet your mind. Be present to what is happening now. Illumination, receiving insight in the center, clarity about our lives and holy energy for the journey. The center is a place for prayer, meditation, and inspiration. Union, journeying out from the center, we take the experience back to our lives. We give thanks for any insights or gifts. We carry a refreshed spirit, a renewed vision, a calm gratitude, a deep awareness, a grateful forgiveness. You are quite clearly the center, and we can only say at the center we gather from you, your divine and fathomless love, your insatiable spirit for receiving Dharma and your unending passion and compassion for disseminating that to us. So please accept this and our practice as our samaya, and please stay, please teach, please teach, please teach, please stay, please stay, please stay. And because bodies don't last forever and every lifetime here for, please bring us to you and allow us to be part of your gathering so that we can serve all beings in all of space.
This card has a, on the cover here, or on the face, a copy of the Tanka in the back, which is a tanka that I just purchased in Dharamsala at a wonderful shop in that all the nuns told me was the best place to buy tankas. And I shopped for quite a while because I'm so cheap that, and I was looking, because I don't like to add things, you know, so something, especially a tanka, because I had tankas, I had statuary, I had bells and dorjis and damarus and all of the implements, accoutrements and all of that. And all of it was stolen in one fell swoop. And the calling card left behind was only a framed picture of Padmasambhava. So I took that as a sign that it wasn't time to fill the garage back up again. But I wanted a tanka of the lake-born Vajra of Soki Dorje. And so this was one that I found, and the proprietress was really extraordinary, a Dzogchen practitioner. She's really probably the reason that I bought that tanka, just because I wanted to spend more time with her. But she told me that as when I told her that I had just finished leading a 2-month retreat on Shamatha, she said, "Oh, Alan Wallace was just in here." And it could be, and I hadn't even thought of this, but Mary Kay mentioned that a dozen or so Tonkas were destroyed in the mudslide at the retreat in near Santa Barbara 2 winters ago, or yeah. And so I wonder if he was maybe filling his garage again. But anyway, she said that he came in looking for a Tonka of, I think it was Avalokiteshvara, but I'm not, it could have been a white Tara, but I think it was Avalokiteshvara. And she said, "Alan Wallace, of course I couldn't take any money from him, so I gave it to him." But so it was interesting that he ended up at the best shop too. But that's the on the cover here. And thank you, Karen, for printing it. And I'll try to get a better picture next time.